the best resource we have as leaders is the great ideas and the motivation, the talent, and the creativity of our workforce. In the case of Edwards, when I showed up, that's 11,000 people. I came from a wing of 4,500 people prior to that. But I realized that the best idea that I could ever have is creating a culture where everyone on my team believed that if they had an idea, someone was listening, someone would consider it, and then someone would act appropriately. It doesn't mean they would follow every piece of advice. That's a horrible idea. But at least they knew that someone would listen, consider, and act, and so on.
Hello, and welcome to the Leadership Launchpad, where we help technical managers improve themselves, their teams, and their organizations. On this show, I talk with industry leaders, coaches, authors, and experts to help give you actionable insights that will help improve your own performance and the performance of those around you. Our guest today is General John Dragon Tykert. General Tykert is a champion for inspirational, innovative, integrity-filled leadership. He has written and spoken extensively on leadership, innovation, national security, risk management, and international affairs. He is an Amazon number one best-selling author and a former candidate for U.S. Senate who maintains a robust schedule of international-level media engagements. I couldn't be happier that he is with us today. I'm not joking. His Air Force biography is the definition of success in the Air Force. He was an F-15E pilot, an F-22 Raptor pilot, a distinguished graduate from almost every school he went to, including test pilot school. He was the base commander at both Andrews Air Force Base and Edwards Air Force Base. Our discussion today focuses on how to drive innovation as a leader. You can expect to learn how even innovative cultures can fall into preferring the status quo, why leaders need to protect innovation from the top while building it from the bottom, what frontline leaders can do to drive change even if their boss doesn't want them to, and so much more. Before we get into the discussion, I do want to remind you to make sure you hit like and subscribe so make sure you never miss a future episode. And if you are already subscribed, then I would ask that you share this show with at least one other person. That, after all, is how we grow. And I can't tell you how much it means to me. So with that, let's get into the discussion with General John Dragon Tykert. John, welcome to the Leadership Launchpad. How are you doing today?
Matt, I am doing awesome, and thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I can't be more excited to have you today, have you here today. There's so many different ways that we could start this conversation, but when, you know, as I started reading your book, the opening story of the book really sparked something in me. You know, I'm in learning and development. A lot of my listeners currently have a learning and development and employee training background. And I'm a big believer in the idea that we're probably 5 to 10 years away from 50% of training being done through augmented reality. You know, it's going to be, we're going to have AI, generative AI is going to create the environments, and we're going to use augmented reality to do all the training. Your opening story was about a project called ACE and using AR, VR, you know, for some of this critical training. I would love for you to describe kind of that story. Like, what is ACE for our listeners, and why is AR, VR kind of like this critical component really to national security in the way that you framed it?
Yeah. So Matt, thanks. That opening story was more about the two airmen that I mentioned in there,
yep.
Michael Meyer and Jeremy Nielsen, and how they had the time and the inclination to dabble in VR, yep. AR, or XR. I don't know. What's the right phrase these days? What do you like to use? Which one?
You know, I myself change it up a lot. Most of the people that I know who are really in the space, I think, do say XR a lot.
Okay. So we'll go with XR. And ACE is Agile Combat Employment.
Okay.
So the idea is somewhere like in the Western Pacific, those bases are big, juicy targets. And so instead of making ourselves vulnerable in these big, juicy target areas, then let us spread out, instead of having a dozen bases that will get taken out on day one, create 100 different locations where we could fly out of or planes could return to. But the only way that that will work is if you've got a small cadre of airmen, or it could be soldiers, sailors, Marines, Guardians, Coast Guardsmen, Merchant Marines, who are ready to catch those planes as they land, refuel them, perform maintenance on them, and reload them with weapons. But here's the problem, that it takes years to train a given maintainer to maintain one type of aircraft. So you can't actually execute agile combat employment without being able to take airmen and find a way to train them on all possible aircraft that could land in the middle of a conflict. And the idea with XR is that a plane lands that the airmen aren't trained in, you slap on the goggles, and now those goggles help guide you through the maintenance tasks, refueling, reloading, maintenance on the aircraft, so that you can actually implement the idea called ACE. Because unless you have the ability to turn any type of aircraft in a given amount of time, day, night, under fire, then you can't actually implement this thing that's going to actually allow us to win a war in a place like the Western Pacific, or more importantly, to deter a war there.
Yeah, it's so true. And I just love kind of that through line of how, you know, these things that we're working on for employee training, you know, something, you know, we're using it for soft skill development and leader development. It applies all the way to the like farthest tip of the spear of enabling people to learn on the fly when needed in order to employ forces the way we need to. As you said, though, like the heart of that story was about these two airmen who were able to kind of experiment and dabble and develop these technologies. Was that happening? That was happening when you were at Edwards. Is that correct? That was something happening.
It was. And that book, Boom, that we'll talk about more, was about changing a culture that was a bureaucratic quagmire into one that was an innovation juggernaut. And part of that was this very compelling story of these two very normal, amazingly talented, but really motivated airmen that were probably in their late 20s, who had a little bit of time given to them to dabble, a little bit of money or resources to dabble. And they saw the compelling need to start developing this capability for maintainers. And then based on what they learned at Edwards, they went on to do other things, including Michael Meyer went to Air Education and Training Command, which is our training development arm in the United States Air Force, and took the gospel of the need for XR in this type of scenario with him and what he learned. And now the Air Force is starting to get a foothold in these technologies for real at scale because of what he saw done at Edwards in our innovation movement, but specifically what he was able to do and learn from based on the dabbling that we gave him the bandwidth to accomplish.
Yeah, that dabbling is so important for innovation. You know, you brought up Boom, and I haven't finished the book yet, but as I've started and as I've listened to you speak about it, it really is a book about how do you create a culture of innovation in many ways in spite of bureaucracy, right? Like how do you push back against that? If you could, you know, so first off, we mentioned Edwards. For those who don't know, what is Edwards Air Force Base?
Edwards Air Force Base is a location in the Mojave Desert, about an hour and a half over the mountains north of Los Angeles, and it has been our primary test and evaluation base since the end of World War II. It's where Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier, and essentially it's been at the nexus of every aerospace first in our country since that time in 1947 that Yeager broke the sound barrier. And so all of these weapon systems, these platforms, these aircraft or weapons on aircraft come through Edwards. We test them in realistic conditions, and then we push them out to the warfighter. And that base is always somewhat on the cutting edge of technology because we get the new things first. But unless the culture is ready to support those new things, or can operate at a pace and scale where we can quickly turn those new things and push them out to the field, then it really is all for naught. And we, when I showed up in 2018, saw that this bow wave was coming in the early 20s. We're there now, where there would be new testing on fighters, bombers, tankers, trainers, mobility aircraft, unmanned aerial systems, revolutionary weapons, AI types of systems. And we needed to fundamentally change our culture so that the airmen that are there now could have the type of surrounding, not just on the flight line, but in everything they did, that could facilitate what our nation would need them to do.
Yeah. I'm really interested because as you described it, you know, Edwards has always been on the leading edge. Like you expect this to be a place of just constant innovation. Yet you're saying like you recognized a need for a change in culture in order to keep up with the pace of what was coming. What were some of the things that you saw when you got there that said, you know, something here needs to change for us to keep up? What was sparking that in you?
There was a few things, and one of them was that there was this amazingly bad dichotomy where you would go out onto the flight line and you'd see this hunk of titanium and aluminum that was a new aircraft, and you'd know that that was cutting edge. But then you explored the processes that we would use to test and evaluate that amazingly cutting edge system, or all of the support assets that would enable the testing to take place. And you just saw that one was cutting edge and the rest was this muck and mire of bureaucracy. And then I had a little bit of a head start because my predecessor recognized the problem and had commissioned a study by one of those big agencies, think tanks that do those types of things, that had assessed us at a failing grade for every element of culture related to innovation. So I knew walking in that there was a problem. I had been there twice before and I hadn't really noticed it, but then I got there in 2018 and saw how bad it was myself that reinforced those studies. And I knew that if we didn't do something immediately, then the culture would never be ready for the things that our nation needed it to do.
Yeah. Outside of the, you know, these processes, which, wow, as a former Air Force pilot and a heavy pilot, yeah, like I can feel you on that. It's all that support structure that you're just like, really, we're still printing this stuff off? Like, is that what we're doing right now? What were some of the things that you saw as the barriers that were cropping up to that innovation? Because I'm assuming, you know, it clearly couldn't have always been this way. What was stopping people from being innovative? And how much of this is just kind of a question of scale? Is it just something that kind of naturally happens as an organization gets big enough?
Matt, I think the problem is that bureaucracies were designed for a very specific purpose, which is to do something repeatably very well. But they're not designed to do anything outside of the norm. They have a very narrow set of constraints. And within those narrow set of constraints, then it can repeat itself very well and very quickly. But the problem is, as the world changes, then the bureaucracy doesn't necessarily follow along. And then there's the other barriers. One of the favorite things I like to do is go out and ask people wherever I go in my leadership capacity, what can I do for you? What are we doing wrong? How can I help? Yeah. And it almost always is a response that's a subset of a few things. People need more time, more people, more money. And so one of those barriers is that great Americans at places like Edwards are trying to do what they have been tasked to do. They are overloaded. They don't have the budget they need. They don't have the people they need. And so if you tell them that we need to do something different, then it raises these red flags because they're already tapped out. And unless they see a compelling crisis looming on the horizon or see something compelling to cause them to shake out of that complacency or defiance that loves the alluring comfort of the status quo, then they're just going to keep doing the things that they've done in the way they've always done them because they're just tapped out and can't see a compelling need to do something different.
That's interesting. I would love to kind of go down that road a little bit more. Just now that I've been out off of active duty for almost a decade now and seen inside, especially a lot of startup cultures, a big part of what drives them is pure survival. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why at SpaceX, they're so successful in maintaining kind of a startup culture is because Elon as a leader is always putting the company in these must succeed positions, right? You know, Starlink, Starship, there's a very big all hands where he called everybody together and said, look, we're doing these two programs. Either one of these two programs, if not executed well, will cause us to go bankrupt, right? You know, so there's a lot of that. We need to survive this. And at least on my reflection, I think when I think about government, when I think about the military, there's much less of that because it's at least the institution is just going to stay there. Like, it's not like the institution is going to fail unless the nation fails, or like some, and you just can't even get your head there. So how much of, I guess this is where we can kind of transition into talking about some of the things that you did there. How do you break people out of that? You said, you know, unless they see this crisis or this compelling reason to change, people are going to be complacent. They're going to stay in this mode of doing what they've done before. So how do you get people out of that when you don't have this startup, like, if we don't succeed, we die kind of mentality?
Yeah. So I think a good leader has to see enough into the future about how the status quo way of doing business is not going to sufficiently accomplish the mission or meet the requirements. Elon and others like that, immediately by the nature of them being scrappy and young and on the verge of failure, it's easy to get there.
Yeah.
But it takes a little bit of creativity and a lot of communication for a leader to help paint a picture of a future where our status quo will be completely insufficient to meet the needs. And especially when you go back, at least in my example or my situation, to our ultimate mission is support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that means to deter a foe from doing those things you don't want them to do. And then if that fails, to be able to defeat them. That's essentially the job of the military. Mm-hmm. And as you see the world changing, wherever that may be, Eastern Europe, Middle East, Western Pacific, elsewhere, and you see that if you look at our glide slope, and you look at an adversary's glide slope, that they have either passed us or will pass us, and there are dire consequences to that, then now you help create a presumptive crisis so that now you sow the seeds for at least a willingness to consider something that is different than the alluring safety of the status quo.
That makes a lot of sense, especially when I think about, you know, I'm still a reservist kind of supporting the Space Force. And as the Space Force has stood up, that's been the drumbeat of every, you know, colonel and above there, is just like that glide slope that you mentioned, like these, like we are ahead right now, but the paths cross and we are not prepared for, you know, the 2030 fight or whatever, you know, whatever the thing is that you put in the future. How did you start to paint that picture? How did you start to create that impetus for change when you became the commander at Edwards? What were some of the things that you started doing to change that culture?
Matt, I think it's first important to realize that leaders shouldn't necessarily jump in and on day one start changing things.
Yeah.
That the best leaders will jump in, and General Goldfein, used to be the chief staff of the Air Force, would say they would squint with their ears, which means they go into a room instead of mouth first, ear first, especially in the beginning, and start to understand the lay down of the situation or the culture or the environment. And then maybe 2 months in, once they've gathered all that data and they understand and maybe have communicated enough to help people understand the looming crisis that is on the horizon, then now they have enough ammunition and credibility to start more marching forward to do something different. And that's the battle rhythm that I typically use. But there is something that I started on day one, because I got the sense as a wing or base commander before I showed up there, I commanded Joint Base Andrews the 2 years before that, that really the best resource we have as leaders is the great ideas and the motivation, the talent, and the creativity of our workforce.
Yeah.
In the case of Edwards, when I showed up, that's 11,000 people. I came from a wing of 4,500 people prior to that. But I realized that the best idea that I could ever have is creating a culture where everyone on my team believed that if they had an idea, someone was listening, someone would consider it, and then someone would act appropriately. It doesn't mean they would follow every piece of advice. Yeah. That's a horrible idea. Yeah. But at least they knew that someone would listen, consider, and act. And so on day one, after all of the fanciful change of command activities, that I got together my core leadership team, I gave my leadership philosophy. But then I did something that was very simple. I handed out note cards and said, write down on this note card, with your name or without, I don't care, the thing that I could do tomorrow that would immediately start making things better for the mission or the workforce. And then I would take those cards and then for the first week, get after it and start advertising the things that we did based on their feedback. And that was the first element of letting my subordinate leadership team and then the broader population know that I truly am starting this process of listening and considering and acting. And the interesting thing about their inputs is that almost all of them were delegations of authority. Instead of you, boss, keeping the authority at your level, it's far better suited to be pushed down as decision makers and leaders down the chain of command.
Yeah.
And we started immediately to delegate authority. That, by the way, is an infinite return on investment. That it costs nothing to do and you get a return, which is an infinite return on investment. And then our team started to believe we were listening, considering, and acting. And then we implemented a lot of other ideas to do the same thing on a broader scale. And it started to catch on such that the entire population was truly believing that we were listening and considering and acting on every idea that they had.
I love that. You know, it really resonates with me because we do a lot of training on receiving feedback. I think a lot of people talk about the art of giving feedback, but really before you give feedback, you need to be good at receiving feedback. And when you look at the research of what's the number one reason why people don't give upward feedback is because they think nothing's going to come of it. They're going to say something, nothing's going to happen. So that makes absolutely a lot of sense that you really kind of drove in on this is, you know, this is how we're going to build credibility of you tell us something and we're going to make sure, especially early on, that we're doing something with this. Another interesting thing from what you just said is this idea of delegation. And I think about this a lot regarding how a lot of people think about what it means to be a new manager. Of a lot of times, you know, because you become a manager, you become a leader by first being technically excellent, right? Like you start with excellence in whatever the thing is that you do, that's what gets you promoted. And then everything flips on its head and it's not about you, it's about the people. But people hold on to this mentality of I'm the leader, I'm supposed to have the answers. And I think in the military, at least for me, you know, for whatever reason, there's this scene from a Matthew McConaughey movie, U-571, where he's like a submarine commander in World War II. And there's this scene where, you know, the chief of the boat is like yelling at him. He's like, no, you're the captain. You always have the answers. Like you're supposed to be steadfast and know exactly what to happen. And it creates this, it kind of furthers that idea, at least that I had, of no, as the leader, you're supposed to be the one in front, the one doing, the one with the answers. How did you have any of that shift that had to happen in yourself? And kind of how do you break apart that dichotomy of like, you're the leader, but it is all about, true leadership is about empowerment.
Yeah, I think then the dichotomy there, Matt, is that a leader is always responsible for the decisions that are to be made.
Yeah.
You don't delegate the responsibility.
Yeah.
You delegate the activity or the very proximate authority to do something, or you help your team to truly believe that you trust them based on what you have seen at the sufficient level that you should trust or delegate, but you still retain the responsibility for those decisions, which is another one of those barriers and why this culture is sometimes tough to create. Because people are naturally, or a lot of people are naturally, risk adverse.
Yeah.
And once you get to a leadership position, you know all eyes are on you. You also know that maybe based on being in that leadership position, maybe there's the next leadership position that you could get to if things go well. And that then deters people from the willingness to take risk, when the reality is that risk management, not risk avoidance, risk management is a fundamental part of leadership. Yeah. And you're never going to move forward if you're not willing to take risk of a variety of levels. I love some quotes, and I can't give them to you exactly right now, but from people like Wilbur Wright, that basically say, don't take dumb risks, but take deliberately accepted risks. And the idea is that you can never move forward if you're not going to manage and take the appropriate risks. It's not about avoiding those risks. It's about avoiding the dumb risks. And I tell people that the risk management model is that you understand the risk, you mitigate reasonably, you understand the right level to accept the residual risk, and then you get after it aggressively. And the problem is that a lot of people, I think, see that their future or their present is tied to doing okay at what they're doing now without making any big mistakes. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, if you're not willing to take some risk and make some mistakes, then you're never going to see things move forward, which is why the status quo sometimes is so alluring, especially for leaders that see all eyes on them and are worried that by taking too much risk or pushing down too much authority or waiving rules, that now they're going to get themselves in trouble and their career is going to be terminal as a result.
And I'm guessing a part of that encouragement of risk is what you said earlier of making a very clear and compelling case for if we don't take these risks, like, we're going to fail. You know, there's this future coming that we have to be prepared for. And so then that kind of changes the risk equation a little bit. Is there anything else you did? Like, is that correct? And then is there anything else you did to kind of encourage that risk taking?
Yeah. And so I think part of it is that what you just said is right for the higher levels of leaders. Okay. But I think the lower levels of your population are thirsting for someone to listen to them and consider them and act appropriately. Mm-hmm. When you and I were young, we were the technical experts, but when we grow up, we're not, they are. And so why in the world should I presume that based on today's situation, I know better than them? And the thing that I found as a result of this journey that we were on is not only did we find ways to improve the mission, but we massively boosted quality of life because people are thirsting for someone to listen to them. And if we unlock their natural talent and unleash our team, then now they're going to be better off and consider themselves better off. And our mission is going to succeed. And we'll create this alumni network like Jeremy Nielsen and Michael Meyer in the XR example. One of the other things, though, that we did is align incentives and relentlessly socialize. And here's what I mean by both of those. The align incentives is that you truly help the workforce understand that at the highest level and down at least as far as my leadership chain was willing to buy in, and we got buy-in in the right way for this, by the way, is that we were going to spend money and spend time and award and recognize and promote based on the types of characteristics that we were looking for in this innovation culture.
Yeah.
And now we were protecting that from the top, but you don't create innovation culture or cultural change from the top. You protect it from the top. You find the right people from the lower level that really now are buying in because someone's finally listening, considering, and acting. And now based on aligned incentives and a top protection and a squeeze from the bottom, then now people are naturally going to see that the best thing for their well-being is to go along, because now not only is there a crisis, not only is there a national security threat, but now this is what the boss cares about. And this is how the boss is spending his time and his money and his opportunities to promote. The relentless socialization is that in order to properly convince a large organization, especially, that it can't just be a fleeting comment from a boss or a leader, and they expect that that fleeting comment is going to get people to buy in. That doesn't work. That is a flash in the pan. That is a buzzword of the day. No one's going to believe that there's actually substance to that. Relentless socialization is that you are talking about this, both the crisis that is looming and the things we are doing to resolve it, constantly. Yeah. And that means dozens of times a day, and how you align your calendar and your checkbook, your time and your money. But you are bombarding the population with this as the priority. And it's not just a mission statement on a wall, but it is the boss constantly talking about this and finding a way to reward or award publicly the people that are part of this movement that are making it happen. And your willingness to take the feedback ideas and start to listen, consider, act. And if you're doing that again and again and again and again, and you're communicating in every possible way and venue and form and at all times, then now you've aligned incentives, you've demonstrated a looming crisis, and now you are talking about all of that constantly. And people are going to either realize they're going to get on board or they're going to get left behind.
Yeah, that last point there is so true. I remember hearing James Carville talk once about, you know, managing political campaigns and how he would have to, you know, kind of grab candidates, because there's be these candidates who are out doing their stump speeches and they'd just be like, I've said this 100 times. I can't say it again. And you're just like, no, you can never say this message enough times. So little of it gets through. It's just about that consistent drumbeat of what the priorities are, what the mission is, the direction is, whatever that most important thing is. You really can't say it enough.
As a part of that, Matt, not only can you not say it enough, but the thousandth time you say it, you need to be just as passionate as the first.
Yeah.
Because that may be the time that you connect with people that you never would have connected with otherwise. And if you give it with a ho-hum, moderate level of passion, then no one's going to buy in and want to jump on that train with you. For me, it's easy. I'm a pretty excitable person. Sometimes my family would say a little too much, a little too extra. But the bottom line is that I believe that a crisis is looming, and I believed in what we were doing about it. And I wanted people so much to understand the way I understand. And leaders not only need to communicate relentlessly, but with the same level of passion in that thousandth time as the first time, so that everybody gets a sense, not just of the words that are coming out of your mouth, but the gleam in your eye and the passion in your heart that can captivate them like it's captivated you.
Yeah, I think that's 100%. That's 100% right. To close out, one thing I did want to make sure to bring it back around on, because, you know, it's great to talk about all of this driving innovation from the top, but the truth is the majority of leaders out there are probably frontline leaders, new leaders, mid-level managers in organizations where the top leadership is still, hey, like, we're going along to get along, you know, this is the status quo. This is what we're doing. If for someone who's in that kind of position where they see the need for innovation, but they don't necessarily have that top protection, like you say, what are some ways that they can still push this forward kind of from the bottom?
Matt, one of the things that you and I have grown up talking about or hearing about is breaking the chain. Whenever there's a safety incident, then it means that there's a chain of links that has aligned. Yeah. And if there is one link that is out of place in the proper way, then it stops the incident from happening.
Yep.
Every leader at every level has a boss, and every leader at every level can break the chain and make sure that down and in, that they are creating the type of culture that is best, even if they can't propagate it up and out.
Yeah.
But then there's some other ways that you can chip away at your boss. And one of those ways is that you communicate to them in a way that helps your boss to understand it's in their best interest to go along or to jump onto this type of mindset or cultural change that you're advocating for. And if you start listening to the way they communicate or understand their priorities or their boss's priorities, and then wrap your argument about what you want to do in a way that resonates with those things you've already heard from them, then you're more likely to win them over. That's one of the tricks. The other trick is I'm a big fan of not asking for permission, but informing my boss what I'm going to do. And here's what I mean by that nuance. If I have something that I want to do in my organization, then I go to my boss, and instead of saying, boss, I want to do this, will you approve? Instead, I say, boss, I plan to do this. Here's why. Just wanted to let you know. And here's the glorious thing about that nuance, that now if they don't say no and stop you, then they actually are accepting all of the risk. And they've implicitly said yes. And now you get to do that thing that you know is right. But now they have accepted the risk without the burden of having to make a decision. And so now wrap your communication in a way that resonates with them, and then do as little of asking for permission as possible. Just tell them what you're doing. And I mean, don't blindside them. Make sure they know what's going on. But once you do that, then there is a passing of responsibility up the chain, whether they know it or not, that is helpful, because now you've got top cover and you can get after it without necessarily risking a no from that individual that you fear might say no if you ask them the question.
I love it. I mean, that first part really is just taking that align and socialize and flipping it around.
It is.
You know, aligning to them and then continuously repeating that message again and again. Yeah. And then it is a nuance, but it's an important nuance of the difference between asking permission and just, hey, this is what I'm going to do. You want to clearly get, you know, it's not about hiding it in line 85 of your weekly summary email, probably.
Nope.
But it's about clearly saying, this is the plan of action. This is the well thought out. These are the reasons why, again, aligned and socialized to what their incentives are as well.
That makes, do a little bit of this is what I'm doing and why. Here's the risks, but how I've mitigated, because that helps too. You want them to know that there is a possibility that this is going to fail. And then once they don't say no, you can get after it. And I think that's hugely important. And you're right. It is flipping the socialization upside down and doing it up the chain like you've done it down the chain as well. And again, everyone's got a boss. And it's also important to know that there's going to be no's. That happened in our journey at Edwards, even though in about 6 months we fundamentally changed the culture, even though experts say it takes 5 to 10 years to do. But that's just a battle you lost. It's not the war. And if you overblow one no, then now likely you're going to shut down all of the other opportunities to get to yes. And then maybe another trick, Matt, is that when you do get a no, then now be the Barney Fife dumb guy boss. Thank you so much for stopping us from doing this thing that you don't think that we should do. I clearly don't have the big picture. Inform me a little bit about why you made that decision so now I can bring you better solutions in the future. Benefit there is now you're learning, you're hearing from them, so now you can craft your next argument better. And maybe in the midst of their explanation, if they're intellectually honest, they find themselves actually at odds with what they're trying to convince you of, and maybe they'll reverse their decision. But I think playing on a little bit of their pride of being a boss and their bigger perspective than you've got, then inform yourself for the next battle because it's a war, not just a single battle.
Yeah, absolutely. It is all about getting yourself closer to them, understanding their decision-making process, getting them in on the process. It reminded me of, there's a thing that we teach called the user manual for me, which is basically just a list of questions of this is how I operate so that you know how to work with me. And one of the questions on there is, it's my favorite question, how do you convince me of something?
Okay.
Right? You know, like what are the arguments? How should you talk to me? Do I want a story? Do I want data? You know, understanding that kind of stuff about whoever you're talking to is really, really essential.
I love that idea. And you're right that you as a boss should want to be able to be convinced, but whether your boss wants to be convinced or not, you could probably pick up a lot of clues along the way about how to best communicate with them in a way that is successful, that you should go to school every time you talk to them and every decision that they make so that the next time it's more likely that you and your team can get to what you think is the right answer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, this has been, this went really fast. This has been a fantastic discussion. I'm sure there's so much more about it because you wrote a whole book about it. Like we said, Boom is, it really walks through so much of what you did to transform that culture. Anything else that people should know about you other than buying the book? How what's the best way for people to reach out to you?
Matt, thanks for asking. And by the way, great interview. I have loved every single minute of it and your questions were spot on. JohnTeichert.com is my personal website. Teichert is T-E-I-C-H-E-R-T. I'm sure you'll put it up somewhere.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm prolific on LinkedIn, so I would ask that people follow me on LinkedIn. And then you mentioned Boom. That's on Amazon. It was a number one bestseller on Amazon. And I have my next book coming out in early September. That's actually going to be a 90-day Christian devotional for use around the election period. So I'm a bit of an eclectic kind of guy, but certainly something that we need in this day and age, something totally different than Boom. But I would love it if people would follow along on my website or LinkedIn to see what else I'm up to.
That's incredible. Very timely. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Matt, you were awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to today's show. If you are looking for help turning your organization's great engineers into great managers, me and my team at Better Everyday Studios would love to help. We deliver targeted and interactive training workshops that are designed to help build the three fundamental skills of any new manager: building trust, giving feedback, and setting goals. Reach out to me through matt@bettereverydaystudios.com so we can start making your organization better every day.